Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Addition Financial, offering their Savings Plus account with a 4% annual percentage yield. Serving Central Floridians since 1937 and was recently named one of Newsweek's best regional credit unions. More at additionfi.com/NPR. Applicable on savings up to $5,000. Rate subject to change, federally insured by NCUA.
The future of commercial space in low Earth orbit. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. Commercial space company Axiom says it's learning from its first all-private mission to the International Space Station last month and planning more commercial missions to low Earth orbit. The company launched four people to the station last month from Kennedy Space Center on SpaceX's Crew Dragon capsule. Axiom is planning to build its own space station, first starting with elements attached to the ISS. Rex Walheim is a former NASA astronaut who flew on the final space shuttle mission. He now works at Axiom and says the team is taking what they learned from that first mission and applying it to future flights.
So the way to have that smooth operation when our station elements arrive is to practice that now with our private astronaut missions, and that's exactly what we did. We learned to work together, and we learned everybody's strengths and maybe some weaknesses and how we can improve, and that will help us as we go forward and build our own space station.
NASA says operations of the ISS will come to an end in 2030 and plans to leverage private stations for future science research. Axiom plans to begin launching its own modules to the ISS, which will eventually separate from the station in 2024. We'll hear from Walheim about Axiom's plans for the future and what it's learning from this first commercial space flight. Then, SpaceX founder Elon Musk is buying the social media platform Twitter. What could this mean for Musk's space company? We'll speak with Quartz business reporter Tim Fernholz about the implications of the buy. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? Here on WMFE, America's Space Station. More than a decade ago, Rex Walheim helped NASA close a chapter of space exploration.
All three engines up and burning. 2, 1, 0, and liftoff, the final liftoff of Atlantis. On the shoulders of the space shuttle, America will continue the dream.
Walheim was on board that final space shuttle mission, launching on Space Shuttle Atlantis in 2011. Now he's part of a commercial company ushering in a new chapter of space exploration, Axiom. Walheim, who is now Chief of Safety and Mission Assurance at Axiom, joins us now to talk about this new era of spaceflight.
Yeah, I think it is an inflection point. It was a big change when I landed on STS-135. You know, the loss of the shuttle program, you know, we knew it was coming, but it was hard to take, you know, for a lot of people. A lot of people lost their jobs, and there wasn't a lot necessarily going on yet in the commercial sector. And over that period of time, we've seen it grow and grow. Yeah. From NASA side and the commercial side, you know, we saw the Exploration Flight Test 1 flown out of the Kennedy Space Center, and that was exciting for the exploration program. And then we started seeing the commercial, more of the commercial cargo flights, and then finally the commercial crew flights about a couple years ago. And so it's exciting to see that really pick up from just NASA commercial crews to actual, civilian commercial crews like Axiom One flight. And to see that really taken off is really exciting. And just, all that's going on in space right now, it's just amazing that it's so busy, and that was part of the complications or the difficulties, I would say, or the challenges of AX1 was just fitting our flight in with everything else that was going on the space station.
Mm-hmm. You kind of alluded to this, when the space shuttle program did end. I mean, we knew that it was ending before your final flight. And there was a brief period of time where there was not much going on and, obviously a lot of things going on behind the scenes. But it seems like in this 10 years, especially these past 3 or 4 years, things are just moving at a rapid pace. I mean, what's driving this development to have something like this happen relatively quickly?
I think it's just the ongoing commercialization of space. We've reached a point where that can really accelerate now that we have crew vehicles that can go to and from the space station. We have the SpaceX vehicle and pretty soon, hopefully, the Boeing vehicle. And we also have some of the suborbital vehicles that are going up and down, too, that are generating excitement. So I think just the commercialization of low Earth orbit and even suborbital space is really taken off. It's allowed people to really participate and get excited about the space program. And I think, there are things that the commercial sector can do quicker than the government can. The government has to pave the ways, pave the way. So the government's really good at true exploration, figuring out ways to get to the moon or go beyond the moon. And then once, a sector is opened up to the commercial side of the house, then the commercial side can take over. So low Earth orbit, we've been doing that, for over 50 years now. And so now the commercial sector is kind of really backfilling where NASA can kind of pull away and let us do the job.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned you were here in Florida. I assume you're here to watch the launch. Were you a bit jealous seeing that crew head up to the space station?
Well, it was really a special day for me because the launch date, April 8th, was exactly to the day 20 years from my very first flight on STS-110. So it was really fun to look out at the crew, what they were doing, and thinking back what I was doing 20 years ago that day and how it felt to, be going to the launch pad for the first time. And the other exciting thing about the launch was to look over. I actually launched on pad 39B on STS-110, so that pad is now taken up by the SLS rocket. So to see this enormous moon rocket on pad B, and then to see our Falcon 9 and Crew Dragon on pad A was just spectacular. It was like, and it really did highlight to me how much things have changed over the last 10, 11 years and how things have really taken off. This is what it was supposed to be like. So it's really exciting to see it come to pass.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a bit about that change, Rex. Training for a NASA mission, for one of your space shuttle missions, I would assume is wildly different than what a commercial astronaut would do for training. And as, chief of safety and mission assurance at Axiom, what have you taken from the way that NASA trains their astronauts and the programs and the safety considerations you put in for your commercial spaceflight astronauts? What's the same and what's different?
Well, the same is we want to make sure that the crews can operate the vehicle properly and safely and effectively. And with the space shuttle, that wasn't that easy. The space shuttle was built, in the 70s and came online in the 80s. And so it was very old technology, very labor-intensive and operator-intensive. And so we had to know, just about everything about the shuttle that affected our flight. And so we had to know all the systems. We had to know how the failures affected each other. And they were all interrelated. And it required a lot of manual input. And so to do that, we had to be really good at it and practice over and over and over. So it was, 9 months to a year of a fairly intensive training program. Now, with the new vehicles like the SpaceX Dragon vehicle, they are a tremendous leap in automation. They've made things so much easier. The one thing where it really strikes me is what we used to call post-insertion in the shuttle program. Post-insertion, you get onto orbit, and then in the shuttle, we would just have to go to work really quick, taking down the seats, putting up a bunch of laptop computers to kind of bring the shuttle into the 20th century and 21st century. And so it was a lot of work to string up those computers and get everything going and get everything put away. With SpaceX, with that vehicle, it's so well integrated that they basically just get to orbit, get out of their seats, and they're ready to go. So it's really pretty impressive the amount of automation that they have done, and as well as with the operation of the vehicle, a lot of the burns are automated, and it can dock autonomously. That's training you don't have to do. So from a certain perspective, it's a function of just how automated and advanced new vehicles are. And then what we do from the commercial sector is, we have taken these vehicles that NASA has certified for commercial crew for their NASA astronauts, and we've accepted, what the work that they've done. And then we kind of try to look at the margins at what has changed from the commercial crew vehicles. Has SpaceX made any changes to the baseline that NASA is flying? If they have, we'd like to hear about some of those. And we don't have the army here at Axiom that NASA has. NASA is great because bringing on a new vehicle, they have an army that can go over it, with a fine-tooth comb, make sure everything is safe to operate and safe to be on. And once they've done that, that allows us to take a smaller group of people and look at the changes that may have been made and to take a look at issues that would affect us. But we don't have a huge range of issues to go over because NASA has done most of that for us.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting point, and I kind of want to prod a bit more into that. the assumption is that with commercial space, you know, it operates kind of either separately or in parallel with NASA. But the way you're saying is you lean on NASA, you know, quite hard for some of these safety things and mission assurance things, right? I mean, without NASA, would there not be an AX-1 mission?
There wouldn't be as quickly as we've seen it, obviously, you know, and it wouldn't be, I don't know how we would do it, you know, with such a lean crew. We have to have a lean crew. If we had to certify the whole vehicle from scratch, it would take, we would have basically had to have hired, you know, the dozens or hundreds of people that NASA has looking at all these issues and do the same due diligence to look over everything. So it would have been very difficult. So I don't know how we would have done it if it hadn't been for NASA certifying the vehicle.
Mm-hmm. When you compare shuttle missions to these SpaceX Crew Dragon missions in terms of risk, what has changed since the space shuttle days and the risk of you know, something happening with Crew Dragon?
Sure. Well, a big part of the risk is flying a new vehicle. You know, you don't know what you don't know yet. But the nice thing about flying on a Dragon and a Falcon 9 is the Falcon 9's flown many times now, you know, with the cargo missions and we've flown a few times with the crew missions too. So, you know, once we get comfortable with the booster, that's very helpful. And then once we get comfortable with the Dragon capsule, you know, we've seen it fly, we've looked over the systems, we understand it better, you know, we get more comfortable with it. But the newness is one area you're concerned with. Now, the nice thing about the Dragon vehicle and the Boeing vehicle is that the capsule's on the top of the rocket. One of the fundamental design issues of the space shuttle was that it was on the side of the stack. And so if anything happened to the stack, the external tank or the solid rocket boosters, in powered flight there was really no way to get off of that stack to avoid a catastrophic situation. With the Dragon and the Boeing vehicles, you're on top of the rocket. So if something happens to the rocket below you during powered flight, you have an escape system. You can get away from the rocket and land safely in the ocean. So that's going back to somewhat of the Apollo era, how they did it. They were smart back then. They knew some really smart ways of doing business. And I think the commercial sector picked up on that and said, yeah, you know, it would be safer if we have that assured abort capability throughout ascent. And that I think that really is a benefit to flying on these new vehicles.
Rex, let's talk about moving forward. Obviously, this isn't the last human mission that Axiom will launch, and there are some big plans to put a commercial space station in orbit. Let me ask you first in the short term, what are you taking from AX-1, and what are you looking at to apply to these future missions, and then how will that kind of lay the groundwork for a commercial space station in the coming years?
Well, I think the first thing it did was, you know, it established that partnership between both SpaceX and NASA. And, you know, there were growing pains. It's the first time we've did it. And, you know, I really look back on it and marvel how well everything went. And when we're talking about doing this, you think, boy, there's a lot of stuff that has to be done. You know, all these payloads we want to fly. You know, we really wanted to do serious research on this mission. And that was to the credit of our AX-1 crew members. They decided they wanted to really, you know, advance the research of spaceflight and to do meaningful work. And they did. But to do that, you have to get all your payloads approved by the safety process and make sure everything's okay. And that is a big effort. And to do it for the first time, you go through all those growing pains. And we did that. And we formed a good partnership with SpaceX and NASA and got all those things approved. And so part of it is learning to work together as a team. And that's one of the big reasons for these private astronaut missions is we want to get to work with NASA while we're on the space station and be a member of the team. Because, you know, it's not too long before we're going to have our own space station in orbit, you know, so we're going to launch our space station and start launching our modules hopefully in the 2024 timeframe. And when we get our modules up on the space station, you know, we're going to be working full-time with NASA because we're going to be up there permanently manning our station for the most part. And when we do that, we need to know their processes and how to work together and have a smooth operation. So the way to have that smooth operation when our station elements arrive is to practice that now with our private astronaut missions. And that's exactly what we did. We learned to work together and we learned everybody's strengths and maybe some weaknesses and how we can improve. And that will help us as we go forward and build our own space station. And then the ultimate goal with our space station, we're building off of the International Space Station. We're bringing our first module, the HAB-1 module, and attaching it to the front of the International Space Station. Then we'll build off that. And once we complete our space station and it's time to deorbit the ISS when it's run out of its useful life, we will detach, and then we will become a free-flying space station. And then NASA will be our guest on our space station. So it'll be great for us to learn to work with them and them to work with us, because eventually the roles will be reversed and, you know, we'll be the owners of the space station and they'll be our guest, which we'll be glad to have there.
And finally, Rex, any chance you will be getting back up there, whether to the International Space Station or to the Axiom Space Station?
It would be a possibility, but you know, I think I'm happy right now just doing my job with safety and helping out with the ops. It's an exciting time and I'm enjoying that right now.
That was Rex Walheim, a former NASA astronaut and now Chief of Safety and Mission Assurance at Axiom. Still to come, what does Elon Musk's Twitter buy mean for SpaceX? Are We There Yet? Is back in a minute.
Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Addition Financial, offering their Savings Plus account with a 4% annual percentage yield. Serving Central Floridians since 1937 and was recently named one of Newsweek's best regional credit unions. More at additionfi.com/NPR. Applicable on savings up to $5,000. Rate subject to change, federally insured by NCUA.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? Here on WMFE, America's Space Station. I'm Brendan Byrne. It was the big story last week. Elon Musk announced a plan to spend some $44 billion to purchase the social media platform Twitter. So what might this mean for Musk's other business ventures, like SpaceX? To find out, we reached out to Tim Fernholz. He's a reporter covering space business for Quartz. Tim, welcome back to the show.
It is a pleasure to speak with you again.
So before we talk about Elon's Twitter purchase, I want to first ask you a bit about the commercial space economy. Earlier in the show, we heard from Rex Walheim. He's a former NASA astronaut. He's now with Axiom Space. They had a pretty big mission last month. When it comes to Axiom Space, what is its place in this kind of broader space economy that's developing right now?
Well, Axiom is a very, I think, unique business because it combines a lot of traditional NASA know-how and experience, particularly in its leadership team. People like Michael Soffredini and Cam Gafarian, who've been involved in the International Space Station for decades now. But it is also adopting the new space, if you want, in quotes, business model of trying to attract private sector investment and private sector customers. And they've really had a nice sweet spot with NASA's goal of creating a new fleet of free-flying space habitats in low Earth orbit for when the ISS is decommissioned eventually. And it's exciting for a lot of reasons. The first all-private mission to the International Space Station, privately owned spacecraft, privately operated spacecraft, privately funded, private citizens on board as passengers. It was a proof of concept in a lot of ways. For Axiom, what it meant was essentially a lot of revenue that will help fund its business operations, a lot of good publicity, and a good record of working closely with NASA to do all the things you have to do in orbit, whether it's proximity operations in the spacecraft at the station, or it's living and working and scheduling, you know, all of the passengers with astronauts on the station, all of these things that you will have to do in the future if you want more private activity in space. Axiom has demonstrated they are capable of doing that. And in dealing with some uncertainty, we saw the delay of the splashdown due to weather issues. And it seems like, you know, NASA and Axiom had planned for that possibility and handled it very well.
Tim, you wrote a piece around the launch of Axiom One headlined, Axiom One Mission is a Giant Leap in Orbital Real Estate. How is this opening up the low Earth orbit real estate market?
So NASA's hope is that by the time the ISS is retired in 2028, 2030, perhaps more likely, private companies are going to step up to operate habitats in low Earth orbit so that NASA can go do the research it wants to do, while directing more of its resources to stuff like going to the moon, which sounds great in theory. But you need to come up with a business model so that works, so that private companies actually do build these habitats and they don't go bankrupt doing it. As recently as 2017, there was a big government study trying to figure out, can a private company sustain a habitat like this? It was pretty skeptical that they would be able to break even. Obviously, Axiom is bullish. They think they can do it. The next thing that we're going to see from them is the installation of a module onto the International Space Station that will be privately operated and owned. But it'll benefit the station. It'll have an additional docking port, and they'll be able to start doing more. But what the Axiom mission is important for is proving that there is a business model, that hypothetically you can charge people money to fly them into space and have them do stuff there and bring them back down. And that is going to get the ball rolling for all kinds of investment. And Axiom isn't the only company that's trying to do this. NanoRacks, which is a major player of the ISS, has its own plans. Blue Origin is developing its own free-flying orbital station called Orbital Reef. And all of these companies basically need to know that they can make money so that they can invest in doing this stuff. And so proving out the concept of operations is important because now Axiom can turn to space agencies in nations that don't have their own human spaceflight programs and say, we'll fly your astronauts, let's say from the UAE maybe, up to the ISS to do some research, to private corporations that might want to do very applied research that's tougher to get onto the publicly operated national lab of the ISS. Television, films, you know, advertising, all of these things that NASA can't do, now Axiom is saying we have the capability to do it. And the question is, will there be a rush of demand for their services? And they're confident there will be.
Mm-hmm. As you mentioned in the piece, you say that, you know, this space tourism aspect of Axiom is really low-hanging fruit. And really, it's looking at this kind of long-term utilization of commercial space. Am I reading into that correctly? That's what they're really focusing on is the long-term sustainability of this economy?
Well, I don't know about the sustainability. I think sustainability is important to them. But what they are focused on is trying to operate their own free-flying habitat and charging people money, charging companies money, charging NASA money, charging universities money to go up there and do stuff and come back down. What Cam Gafarian, who's the chairman of the company, told me last fall was they see through about 2024, maybe 2025 now, they're going to get most of their revenue from private missions up to the ISS, from people paying them to go there. But after that, they hope to transition to a point where they're getting more money operating their own module on the ISS and then splitting it off. And if that succeeds, they're going to be basically landlords in space, and anyone who wants to rent time on their station can come do it. What Blue Origin has called it is a mixed-use industrial park in space. And you have companies like Redwire or Space Tango that want to go up and use these platforms to do, you know, advanced manufacturing in microgravity. That's a business model that people are excited about. It hasn't been fully proved out yet, but that's something that could bring a lot of money in if they get it right.
Mm-hmm. There is a deadline to all this, right? NASA says the ISS will be no more by 2030. Is this enough time for commercial companies like Axiom to start putting the groundwork in there and filling the gap that will surely be left when the ISS is decommissioned?
That is the big question. It had better be enough time from the position of NASA. We all saw what happened when the space shuttle was retired and the U.S. went a long period without having a human spaceflight program. Losing the ISS and not having other platforms in low Earth orbit would be the same sort of thing. We would have, you know, the Falcon 9 and all of these great vehicles to go up to low Earth orbit, but nothing to go to there. So one interesting thing to think about is Axiom's strategy is to start with the ISS with its own module and then split off. But these other companies that I mentioned, like NanoRacks or Blue Origin, want to begin with just a free-flying orbiter of their own. And maybe that will be easier or faster. They won't have to worry about interfacing with the NASA station or NASA's requirements, and they'll be able to sort of do a very lean commercial station. So there's a couple different ways that people are approaching this problem. But will it actually be able to host astronauts, you know, a week after the ISS is decommissioned? It's very hard to say at this point, and it depends probably on continuing investment from NASA and the private sector over the next 5 or 6 years.
Mm-hmm. Tim, let's get to the topic of Elon Musk and Twitter. As you mentioned in your newsletter, it does seem like business as usual for Elon. On the day he announced his buy, he was working on a new engine, the Raptor, at his facility in Boca Chica, Texas. But as you reported, attention won't be the issue for Elon. Instead, it's going to be funding. Kind of unpack this for us.
Yeah, absolutely. So obviously, you know, Elon just has entered a deal to buy Twitter. And one of the initial reactions, of course, is Elon is going to be distracted from Tesla, from SpaceX, from Neuralink, from the Boring Company, and then you start to think, oh, this is the guy who's already operating five companies. So I don't know if distraction is going to be the concern. You know, he has shown an ability to sort of empower teams and leaders for at least a little while and let them run on their own. So whatever the secret of Elon's management is, you know, that's one thing. But, you know, investors in SpaceX may be worried because this is going to be very financially stressful for Elon. And the context here is last fall, there was an email that was reported on in The Verge that Elon sent out to SpaceX employees where he said, you know, we really got to get the Raptor engine production sorted. We need to be flying Starship twice a week in 2022 if we want to avoid bankruptcy. Obviously, Starship is not going to fly twice a week in 2022, at least where we're sitting now, where we don't even have regulatory approval for a SpaceX launch. So, you know, Elon is impulsive and he says things that, you know, maybe he just was really angry about the engines in that moment. But there's real financial stress on SpaceX right now. It's an investment mode. Right now, SpaceX is building out the Starlink satellite network. It's developing the Raptor and testing the Starship, its new heavy lift launch vehicle. These are multi-billion dollar projects. And SpaceX, while it's well capitalized, is going to need more money. And Elon said as much on Twitter when talking about that bankruptcy email. So now we look at the sort of economic cycle we're in. This week, the Federal Reserve Board is meeting. They're going to hike interest rates. We're already seeing tech stocks falling quite a bit. Stock market in general is going to be probably readjusting over the next 6 months. And when SpaceX goes to raise capital, it's going to be a, you know, less friendly environment for that, despite all of the successes that SpaceX has had. And when investors are putting capital into SpaceX, they look at Elon Musk, one of the world's richest people, and say, you know, SpaceX is Elon's arguably favorite company. I would say it's his the closest company to Elon's heart. If we put money in here, we know that Elon is going to make sure the company survives with his own money and his own resources no matter what happens. Well, now Elon is financing $44 billion to purchase Twitter, and that has some ramifications. We've already seen Tesla's stock price falling because Elon is using that stock to finance his purchase. Now, he has plenty of money, but the stock continues to go down. He's going to be on the hook for a good chunk of about $13 billion of loans that he has taken against his Twitter holdings, or sorry, against his Tesla holdings. And Twitter itself is going to have to pay around $1 billion every year of debt service. And what that means is that the next time that Elon wants to put money into SpaceX, he may have to make a choice between, you know, am I selling too much Tesla stock that I could potentially lose control of this company or cause investors to lose faith in it? Am I spending too much money keeping Twitter going? Do I need to keep it alive as a business because of my ego? And this is not even getting into whether the decisions he makes about Twitter will cause it to become profitable or not. And then there's SpaceX. And so essentially, this is not so much a question of Elon's, you know, time. It's a question of his money. And if financial conditions get worse, if Twitter turns out to be a continuing money loser and Tesla stock keeps going down, that could put SpaceX in a difficult position when it needs capital. That's a speculative scenario. But to me, that is the biggest concern for SpaceX investors and SpaceX employees, if you're thinking about the future of the company and what that Twitter purchase might mean for it.
Mm-hmm. It's a complex story, and one of the many reasons I'm glad we have you reporting on it. Tim Fernholz covers space, the economy, and geopolitics for Quartz. He's the author of Rocket Billionaires, Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, and the New Space Race. Tim, thank you so much for your insight.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Brendan.
Well, that's going to do it for this week's show. Be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed. Get it on NPR One, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, just wherever you get your podcasts. Or do it the old-fashioned way. Visit WMFE.org/Are We There Yet. Are We There Yet is a production of WMFE, America's space station. Editorial guidance this week from LaToya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.